Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for the Doctors Roundtable, a forum for conversations with Atlanta's leading doctors and thought leaders about cutting-edge trends and topics in health, wellness, and lifestyle issues. Here's our host, Tanya Mack.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us. I'm Dolores Hartley, guest host, friend, and a nursing colleague of Tanya Mack, who's traveling today. We have a very interesting program with a great panel joining us today, and our topic is unintentional injuries in children, the prevention and treatment. And when we're looking at unintentional injuries in children, it's a leading cause of death in the United States. Each year in the U.S., approximately 9.2 million ER visits are attributed to these injuries, and over 12,000 children die from these. The top causes are motor vehicle injuries, suffocation, burns, drowning, falls, and poisonings. Many are preventable. In this radio segment, we are fortunate to have representatives from the CDC who monitors and reports on these, urgent care medical providers, and consumer group representative to discuss both the prevention and treatment of these injuries. So welcome to our panel, and I'll start our introductions with Dr. Grant Baldwin, who is with the CDC and in his current position since 08 as Director of the Division of Unintentional Injury Prevention. And he has his Master's in Public Health from Emory, and a PhD in health behavior and health education at the University of Michigan. And so we welcome Dr. Baldwin, and I'll just let you give us a little bit of information about your position there at the CDC, if you would.
Yeah, thanks, Dolores. It's certainly a pleasure to be here. CDC is the nation's public health agency, is really focused in on a population health level about how we can prevent childhood injuries. And I've been at CDC for going on 16 years now, and we're passionate and committed to both understanding these public health problems and coming up with solutions.
Thank you. That's great. Now, from the Urgent Care Center, we have Well Street Urgent Care, represented by Dr. Lee Resnick, who is a board-certified family practice physician residing in Cleveland, Ohio, but frequent visitor to Atlanta. His MD is from Case Western Reserve, and he did his residency at Case Medical Center. He is passionate about national efforts on clinical excellence for urgent care medicine. Welcome, Dr. Resnick. Tell us a little bit about your role there with Well Street.
Thanks, Dolores. It's also a pleasure to be here. I am the Chief Medical and Operating Officer for Well Street Urgent Care, which is a network of 8 urgent care centers in the metro Atlanta area. And we are obviously part of the front lines for managing childhood injuries. So we experience this every day. I have a special interest in concussion management, which is a pretty hot topic these days, and something that is a major concern when it comes to prevention of unintentional injury in teens primarily.
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Also with Well Street is Dr. Stephen Keith, a pediatrician who was a fellow with the Academy of Pediatrics and a diplomat of the American Board of Pediatrics, undergraduate work at Amherst in Massachusetts, MD degree from University of Illinois, and then his pediatric residency at the University of California. Dr. Keith is currently the site director for Well Street Urgent Care here in Atlanta, a position he's had since 2012. Welcome, Dr. Keith.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate the opportunity to participate. As you said, Dolores, I am a pediatrician, and we do take care of the full range of ages at Well Street, but clearly, you know, my focus and enjoyment is in terms of taking care of children. And we are highly committed to providing the highest quality of care, the most appropriate care, at the right time. And that's what we try to do at Well Street. My particular facility is in South Buckhead, right on Peachtree. And we look forward to seeing, you know, patients, families, all age ranges. And so we're happy to be here today.
Thank you for being with us. And certainly not least, we have Megan Polashek, an RN, and Master in Public Health fellow from Safe Kids, and it's a consumer group associated with Children's Health Care of Atlanta. And Megan has her nursing degree from the University of Kentucky and her master's in public health from the University of North Carolina. Welcome, Megan.
Thank you so much, Dolores. It's great to be here and to be in the room with all these experts in injury prevention. And one of the great things about Safe Kids is it's a nonprofit organization focused on preventing accidental injuries to children 14 years of age and younger. And so what that means is I get to be in the community almost every day working with parents, caregivers, and children, teaching them about the importance of preventing these injuries and also giving them the tools and resources to do this.
Great. Okay, well, you can see what a great panel we have, and I'm going to start back with Dr. Baldwin at the CDC and say, could you discuss with us briefly the prevalence nationally and in Georgia on unintentional childhood injuries?
Sure, Dolores. Unintentional injuries such as those caused by burns, drowning, falls, poisoning, and traffic crashes are the leading cause of death for children and adolescents in the United States. In 2010, that amounts to 8,700 children between the ages of 0 and 19 who unfortunately lost their lives as a result of an unintentional injury. And really, we talk a lot in injury prevention that those deaths are really just the tip of the iceberg. As you mentioned, there are 8.8 million children treated in emergency departments for non-fatal injuries annually. And we have made some progress. The number of childhood injuries have dropped nearly 30% in the last decade. But as I mentioned, it's still the number one killer of children. In Georgia, about 350 children and adolescents 19 years of age and younger die each year. And unfortunately, the rate in Georgia is actually higher than the national rate. It's about 20% higher. And we're not exactly sure why that's the case, but we do know that injury rates do vary by state. And states with the lowest injury death rates are actually in the northeast. Fire and burn rates are the highest in the southern states, including Georgia.
Thank you. Amazing statistics when you get down to it there and hear all that. Are these injuries variable in geography, gender, or age?
They are. They vary across all of those categories. So there's wide state-to-state variation, and the rates among males are twice the rate among females. What we all want is to keep our children safe and secure and help them live their lives to their full potential. I think one of the other things I want to mention is that the U.S. rate is four times the rate of other high-income countries such as Sweden and the Netherlands. And that's really a benchmark for us here in the United States that there's much more progress that we can make.
I think you've already mentioned it, but again, what are the top causes of unintentional injuries? What would you put as your top priority there, or the one at the top?
Yeah, they really vary by age. So okay. Under the age of one, the leading cause is infant suffocation. Between 1 to 4, it's drowning. And between 5 and 19, it's motor vehicle crashes.
Okay, so we do have a stratified age group here for the different injuries. That's really interesting, too. Mm-hmm. One thing you mentioned about the male-female rate, the male being twice as much as the female, is that because the guys are just more risk takers than those girls?
I don't know about that. I think there are some gender differences based upon sort of risk exposure that may help explain that. And I certainly would be interested to hear from the physicians on the ground to sort of help disentangle that as well.
Absolutely. So now we're going to just go to a good discussion here, and we'll just take the different topics and Dr. Keith, you want to talk to us and get us started here on what you've seen and what experience you've had on injuries from motor vehicle accidents?
Well, at Well Street, you know, we do see a range of injuries coming in, both for children and adults. We really don't see that many motor vehicle accidents coming to Well Street because our niche is largely for patients with urgent issues, not necessarily requiring an emergency department. Typically, motor vehicle accident, just to be on the safe side, are taken to an emergency department. So we don't see that many. I have seen in my career a number of children involved in motor vehicle accidents, and it's truly unfortunate. A lot of this can be addressed by appropriate use of seat belts as well as car seats. And it's been difficult over the years to try to convince parents of the importance of car seats and seat belts. It's still frustrating to drive along the streets here in Atlanta, as in all areas around the U.S., and see children who are not properly in seat belts or car seats for their size. And we really have to understand that the appropriate use of restraints is determined by age and size. And just because a child is over a year of age doesn't mean they shouldn't be in a car seat.
Absolutely.
They really have to be in the appropriate restraint for their age and size.
So for most of the time, those motor vehicle accidents are going to go straight to Children's Health Care of Atlanta or some of our area hospitals. And Megan may want to speak to us about the safety issues that you were just alluding to for motor vehicle accidents.
Definitely. It seems like in interacting with the parents on the ground, they understand that their children under a year of age need to be in a car seat. And they even get it when you talk about children between the ages of 1 and 4. Where we're seeing a lot of parents have a disconnect is when they reach that age that they need to be transitioning into a booster seat. And a lot of parents aren't aware that Georgia passed a law that in 2011, any child under the age of 8 needs to be in a booster seat or an appropriate child restraint. So that's your car seat, your infant care, or things like that. And one of the best things a parent can do to make sure that their child is in the appropriate car seat or booster seat for their age, their height, and their weight is to go visit a local child passenger safety technician. And they can find those folks through Safe Kids. They can also find them through fire departments, police departments throughout their county. They can do a quick Google search to find one in their area. And I really do recommend that. In order to become a child passenger safety technician, you have to go through a 4-day mm-hmm. training course. And it seems like a car seat would be a really easy thing to install. It's not. As someone who's been through that course, it actually could be really difficult. Mm-hmm. And we know that about 8 out of 10 seats are actually misused. So that means they're either installed incorrectly or the child is in the incorrect seat for their age, their height, and their weight. And so that's really important information for us to let parents know. And if you have any question, these seat checks are free. Often you can find one in your community at a Walmart on a Saturday afternoon or maybe a community event. So those are things to look out for.
And I guess I'm sitting here thinking, it's not that the parents don't want to do that. It's when you get to a certain age of child who's more rebellious. Mm-hmm. You know, have we gotten anything through Safe Kids that incentivizes or some tricks to the trade to get those older kids secured in their seats?
One of the things that my job really helps me to understand is I'm really giving parents tools to negotiate or to say you are the parent and to empower them to make those tough decisions. And I've watched time and time again, it's a difficult conversation for parents, especially when you've got a 6 or 7-year-old that tries to rationalize with you. You know, no, you do have to sit in your booster seat, and yes, you will buckle up. And so we really try to help parents to have that conversation and to empower them to be the parent. And often we will tell them what the best practice is, and then we say, but you as the parent have to make those tough decisions about what you're going to do. And the other time that we hear parents kind of have this issue is when we talk about teenagers and who should be riding in the front seat. And we recommend that no child under the age of 13 be in the front seat. They really do need to be in the back seat for multiple reasons, the first of which is airbags. They often sit too close to the airbags, and so if they deploy, mm-hmm. they're at high risk for injuries. And as technology has improved, we see less of those injuries, but we still have a large portion of those. So I always say the back seat is the safest place.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Resnick, any other thoughts you might want to add to this conversation?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm a prevention expert, but I'll represent some of the practical realities on the ground and just as a parent myself. And I think that, let's face it, parents are juggling a lot of competing realities.
Absolutely.
And challenges. And, you know, it's just human nature to try to take the path of least resistance on some of these things. So I think that Megan hit on a pretty good point with regards to ease of use. I think it should be a major target for us because it eliminates even one barrier to utilization. And so if it's easy to set up and easy to use, they're just more likely to use it. If they have to, you know, they've got their purse over their shoulder and a kid in one arm and they're trying to, you know, click this thing together, they're just less likely to use it.
You're right. You're exactly right.
Can I jump in here, Dolores?
Absolutely.
One thing I want to add to the conversation is as children age and reach their driving years in adolescence, one of the more progressive things that has allowed us to save lives is graduated driver's licensing. This is where teens learn to drive in a supervised, practice-based manner under their supervision of their parent or caregiver, learning first to drive under low-risk conditions, with limiting the number of passengers and the hours of operation of the vehicle. And then over time, as they gain experience and confidence, they're able to sort of drive more freely. And that's just been absolutely critical. As graduated driver's licensing laws have spread across the United States, that's been one of the principal drivers of the reduction in teen fatalities.
Good point. And where are we in Georgia with that?
Well, Georgia does have the TADRA legislation, which is basically Georgia's equivalent of GDL. I don't know the statistics on the off the top of my head in terms of lives saved, but it has been important, essential, and progressive legislation right here at home.
Great. That's good to know. All right. Drownings is another unintentional injury. Anybody want to start us on that topic and give us some information?
Sure. I can jump in. As I mentioned, drowning is a leading cause of death for children 1 to 4. Under the age of 1, children most often die, unfortunately, in bathtubs. Between 1 to 4, it's in pools. And over the age of 4, it's in natural bodies. I think one of the themes throughout the conversation today is that there are interventions that we know work. And within drowning, four-sided isolated fencing with a pool latch that prevents intrusion into the pool area is one of the known effective interventions. There's increasing evidence in the literature that learning to swim programs also help. Supervision is critical across all unintentional injury topics, and that's the case here as well. Of course, CPR is essential as well.
I would expand upon your comment about supervision, that it's there was a national study of drownings that happened several years ago. And from that study, we actually found out that 9 out of 10 of the children who drowned, there was a parent or caregiver who claimed to be supervising the child at that time. And so when we talk about supervision, we mean active supervision. This is being within an arm's length of your child. This is not reading a book, not being on your phone, not texting, not reading email. This is, you know, having your eyes on your child and being there in case something goes wrong. Children drown quickly, quietly, and it can happen in the blink of an eye. And so that's one of the things that I always try to make sure that parents understand. And the other thing is, while there's a pattern to drownings, just because your child's between the ages of 1 and 4 doesn't mean that they couldn't drown in another situation or location. And so really making sure that they understand a lot of these principles and preventions cross all of, you know, whether it's a lake or a pool or a pond, you know, that may be in a backyard.
Yeah. That active supervision, that's the key right there, too, for many, many of these injuries, for sure.
Before we go on, though, you know, the loss of a child due to drowning, it mm-hmm. can happen in a few minutes, and it really devastates parents. It's really sad for that child. It really is one of the, you know, situations that's truly preventable mm-hmm. that we as parents can have an active role in. And I'd also like to understand the four-sided fencing around the pool, not just three-sided with the fourth being the house and the entry from the deck.
Good
because
point.
The four-sided isolation fence reduces a child's risk of drowning by 83% compared to a three-sided fence.
Wow.
That's huge.
It's significant, absolutely.
And we're talking about, you know, these are real situations that can be prevented by a very, very, very simple intervention, a four-sided fence that has a latch that the child can't crawl over, under, or around.
So I think you'll hear us talking a lot during the hour about the preventability of these injuries. And one of the things I sort of want to also disentangle is this question of them being accidents. Accidents implies fate and chance. But as you'll hear from us over the course of the hour, there's really nothing accidental about these. The precautions that we can take, it's like having life-saving medicine and not taking it. That's what these interventions represent.
Absolutely agree with that statement. Anybody else have any other comments? Okay.
The only other thing that we haven't touched on, I don't know if you're going to move away from talking about drownings, but the importance of life jackets when you're in an open water situation like the ocean, lakes, ponds. In Georgia, we had several high-profile drownings last year in Lake Lanier, and as a response to that, we've seen some legislation proposed around children wearing life jackets. They're actually looking at increasing the age at which children need to be wearing life jackets. And, you know, even if your child is a strong swimmer, there are other factors that may be out of your control. And in the case of the drownings last year, that's what happened. And so, you know, you never know what can happen. And so you just want to make sure that you have that life jacket on. It's not enough just to have it with you. In the event of an emergency, it needs to be on already, not that you're putting it on.
Do you want to speak to one of those specific incidences where we should have had a life jacket and we could have prevented something, or is it just a generic thing or general thing that you're remembering?
Really, it's a general thing, but, you know, open water is always one of those things that it's always important to have a life jacket on. Like I said, you never know what happens. In the case of the two incidents last year, it was another driver that was involved, as another result of that, we're seeing some legislation around the alcohol limit for boating. So in Georgia, the current law is that anyone at a 0.1 level can drive a boat, and they're considered boating under intoxication. For driving, just as a reference, it's 0.08. So they actually can have a higher alcohol limit on a lake driving a boat than they can in a car.
That's scary.
So, yeah.
Very scary.
So what our legislators are trying to do is reduce that limit to make it equal with what it is for motor vehicles to that 0.08.
Wow. Thank you.
And going back to the life jackets, it's important to understand that we're talking about real life jackets, not water wings, not inflatable round things.
Toys.
Or whatever. These are toys you buy at Toys R Us. No, they do not work. They do not substitute for a life jacket.
So. Well, I'm one of the low-risk females here, and I've got my life jacket on if I'm at the lake, for sure. That's scary territory to me.
I'm curious to hear if Megan's heard anything about the incidence of hot tub drownings. Often hot tubs are not part of that four-sided fence. Mm-hmm. They stand alone. Mm-hmm. And while most of them have covers, if the cover is not latched, a young child could think it's a fort or something to play in, and you sneak under it. Once you're under it, that's not a good thing. Do you hear anything about that?
You know, I really try not to single out one situation like a pool or a hot tub, because we also know inflatable pools are an area of risk. Mm-hmm. So when I talk about reducing the risk or reducing access to water, I talk about buckets, I talk about inflatable pools, making sure that anything that holds more than an inch or so of water is emptied out or secured so that nobody can get into it. So that's where that four-sided fence and really looking at the risks in your home.
It's a great way to look at it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Now we're going to talk about childhood sleep injuries, suffocation, looking at the safe environment, and the importance of CPR training. So, pediatrician, here we go.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind in terms of the suffocation injuries that you find in infants is the sudden infant death syndrome.
Yes.
And this has been a vexing problem for a number of years. But not too long ago, it was determined that, in fact, the sleeping position is the main issue relative to preventing sudden infant death syndrome. Parents know, you know, in years past, that any position to get the child asleep was going to be what you wanted to do. However, it's been shown that the prone position, i.e. laying face down, chest down, actually increases your risk for sudden infant death syndrome significantly. So we always recommend to parents that the child be sleeping on their back is number one. Number two, the use of wedges to make sure that the child is sleeping on their side is also associated with an increased risk of suffocation. Hmm. And so we've got to get away from that.
Yep.
Just flat on the back is the safest way. As well, the crib design and use of extra pillows in the crib is a guaranteed way to increase risk of suffocation, because children with these extra pillows or cushions or whatever can get wedged into the side of the crib and then that leads to a suffocation. And these are things that are preventable. This is not just accident. This is not just fate, because we as adults put these pillows in the crib.
Yes, we do.
And we need to have a crib that doesn't have anything else in it but a mattress and the walls up. Sleeping on the back, that's the best situation to prevent the suffocation, to lower the risk of sudden infant death syndrome.
Let me add to that. I think the other thing that hasn't been mentioned this far is co-sleeping. Mm-hmm. So instead of having the child in a crib or bassinet, is bringing them into your adult bed. And unfortunately, there are instances where adults roll over in their sleep and the infant dies as a result of suffocation in that way. And that's just tragic.
Again, and the tragedy, you're right, is, you know, those all of these things we're talking about when we're saying preventable, you know, that's what's left behind, and you're dealing with it emotionally and psychologically if it's impacting you personally, mm-hmm. is huge. So any other thoughts here?
Not from me.
Okay. All right. How about CPR training? Safe Kids encourages that, I'm sure, in different areas.
I think as a parent, CPR is always a good skill to have and to know, along with the Heimlich maneuver. unfortunately, kids don't come with instruction books or much training. But, you know, CPR can be very helpful in a lot of these situations. In terms of safe sleep and suffocation, really those preventative efforts before you need CPR are the best measures.
Absolutely.
So that minimal sleep environment without pillows, just a fitted sheet, things like that.
That's great. But I wanted to ask, too, from a Safe Kids perspective, and when you're doing the trainings, do they also offer CPR in the community setting? Or
many of our Safe Kids coalitions do. They're affiliated with local hospitals or health departments, and so that's how they do, or fire departments. So it really depends upon the coalition and the county. But you can often find community CPR courses that are free or at a reduced charge. So I do encourage parents to take the time to go ahead and seek that out.
Yes, thank you. All right, now we're going to move along to burns, looking at some immediate treatment. And again, it's going to depend on the extent of the injury as to where you're stopping, urgent care or the emergency room. But anybody want to give us some information on weighing in on this, even looking at, again, the prevention on teaching safety and alarms in the home?
Sure, let me do that. Let me set the stage that by saying that in 2010, someone died in a fire every 2.8 hours. So obviously younger children are particularly vulnerable to burns, and they're more likely to sustain injuries from scald burns that are caused by hot liquids or steam. Older children are more likely to sustain injuries from flame burns with direct contact with fire. You sort of hinted at one of the principal prevention strategies, and that's the having a functional smoke alarm in the home and having them located throughout the home so that a fire, regardless of its location in the home, alerts the family that they need to get out. And
Absolutely.
Having a fire escape plan has also been shown to be effective to complement the smoke alarm.
So, urgent care, any comments there on the burn injury,
sure,
or how to treat it?
Well, we see a lot of minor burns at the urgent care. And in the pediatric population, I think one of the most important in terms of follow-up and proper care are the palmar burns, which is the palm side of your hand. And these most frequently happen when a child lays their flat hand on a hot burner. Often it's after the meal's been cooked, but the burner's still hot. So those are palmar hand burns, and frequently they cover the entire surface of the palm just because of the mechanism, as opposed to, you know, somebody touching something with a finger. It's just the finger that's involved. These are involving the entire palm, and the risk associated with these, they're often deeper surface burns, second degree burns, and sometimes even third degree burns. But even with a second degree burn that involves the entire palm, while it doesn't cover a large surface area, there's significant risk for scarring and contractures. And it is one of those burns that should be managed by a burn center. And, you know, we're fortunate in these major metropolitan areas to have specialists who really understand the proper care and follow-up of these. So that's just a little warning out there. That's not a minor burn. Palmar burns should be taken care of at a burn center. other burns, simple things to think about. You don't want to put a burn on ice. Ice burns as much as, not as much as heat, but ice burns. So it's just cool water as quickly as possible to, to cool down the injured surface. And then primarily it's infection control and pain control from there. There are some antibiotic ointments that you can use on a burn to prevent infection. My word of caution here is that one of the most common Neosporin is actually not a very good topical antibiotic for burns. And one of the primary reasons is that Neosporin itself can cause some sensitization and some allergic response. It's about 20% of people have allergy to Neosporin, and it'll make it look like they're actually infected, and the reality is they're just reacting to the Neosporin. So we generally recommend bacitracin, which is available over the counter as your burn ointment, and then you want to keep that burn clean, dry, and covered otherwise.
From a prevention perspective, from scald burns, one of the things that we do recommend is having a governor on your water heater to prevent the water temperature from becoming so hot that a child who turns, who sort of opens a faucet and turns the heat up can't be unnecessarily burned, because the water heater's governor sort of regulates the extent to which that temperature goes above, reaches a level of actually being able to scald a child.
Excellent point.
Along with that, some other prevention messages that we have are around, like you said, the burns on the palm. So one of the things that we like to let parents know they can do is create a kid-free zone around that stove, because not only will the burners potentially cause an issue, the oven itself, when it opens, kids often get real close and they like to lean in or look in. So we create a kid-free zone where they know that they're not allowed to be, or where they should stand back a couple feet from that area, or maybe creating a kid-friendly zone in your kitchen where they are allowed, where they can help you. Because, you know, having kids in the kitchen helping do what they can, that's age appropriate for learning to cook and get some of those skills is a good thing and a good way to spend family time. So just establishing that kid-friendly zone and that kid-free zone. And then one of the other things we had talked about was the smoke alarms and having a plan if you do have a fire in your home, and practicing that plan. That is so important so that people know what to do. You get a little frazzled in an emergency. And so, you know, having your kids practice that can be fun, but it can also help them remember what they're supposed to do in that emergency. You never want to be in a situation where a family member's having to run back in the house to try to find someone. And smoke alarms, it's great to have them installed in your house. You need to remember to check them and change those batteries. We often say to do it when you turn your clocks forward and back. And so we just had that time. So if you haven't had a chance to check the batteries or test your smoke alarm, now's the time to do it.
Excellent advice. Thank you, Megan. Moving on now, we're looking at poisonings. And these can be challenging because we've got bright colored drinks and household chemicals. So we're looking at, you know, how do you prepare the environment and maybe some immediate treatment, some resources out there. So I see you perked right up when I mentioned that. So sure. I will start with Dr. Baldwin.
Sure. Medications and household cleaners are obviously a real problem for young children. Keeping those up and away and locked up makes a tremendous amount of sense. One of the things that have prevented poisonings is the innovation of medication safety caps that prevent young children, exploratory as they are, from getting into pill bottles. But we've also seen a rise in poisonings in recent years as a result of in the teen population with prescription drug overdoses, prescription painkillers such as OxyContin, hydrocodone, are also a growing problem even in the teen population.
I want to add to that, we have medication caps that are supposed to be childproof. They're really child resistant. One of the things that Safe Kids recently released this week was that about 80% of the medication poisonings that are reported, it's an adult's medication that the child has gotten into. So realizing that they do have these caps that will slow the child down, but it is not childproof. And so your second line of defense needs to be having them locked or up and away, out of sight, where the child cannot reach them.
True.
Because small children do get into, you know, medications for the adults and the grandparents.
Yes.
Grandparents typically will have more medications. They'll have them on the counter
mm-hmm.
or next to the bed, and it's easy enough for children to get to those. And they can have very, very bad outcomes. Just to put, you know, from a mathematical or a statistical standpoint, in the U.S. every day, 87 people die as a result of unintentional poisoning every day.
Wow.
And another 2,200 are treated in hospital emergency departments. This is a significant issue.
Yes. And you're bringing these numbers to us is great, because I think until you can put a number on something, it's easy to just kind of, you know, let it go into the back files or whatever. But we're talking about poisoning specifically. But while we're here, I just wanted to get your input on just something that I was listening to about young people exposed to the high caffeine contents of some of our energy drinks. That's not poisoning, but we've got a fine line there where they're being impacted health-wise from that in urgent care. Would y'all speak to that?
So what you might see, what tends to be the biggest risk is combinations of mind-altering substances. So caffeine is a mind-altering substance. It also impacts cardiac function. And if you combine a highly caffeinated beverage with perhaps something with a high sugar content and other substances in that beverage with a prescribed drug, often a prescribed drug such as an ADHD drug, which is also a stimulant, that's when you usually get into danger. Most healthy children are not going to get into trouble by drinking one energy drink. I could think of other reasons not to drink energy drinks, but it's generally combinations of things or excessive exposure, drinking five energy drinks just for mm-hmm. the high. But my biggest concern is when they're already on a stimulant drug, which is pretty common these days, to combine that with another stimulant is extremely dangerous.
Dolores, could I call out one more prevention strategy in poisoning that we haven't called out yet, and that is calling poison control centers. So the 800 number for poison control centers is 1-800-222-1222. Hopefully in the rare instance that a child has gotten into a household cleaner or medication, poison control centers are an invaluable resource to all of us quickly understand what needs to be done and the precautions that need to be taken in those events. So I think it's great to have that number programmed into your cell phone, put on your refrigerator, and by all the phones that you have in your house.
Another in case of emergency number that we need to have handy. Now, I was going to go back to our pediatrician over here, just thinking about when my children were young, I was told to keep Ipecac there at the house. But that's not always the safe thing to do, because you can speak to when you should and should not use a drug like that.
I think keeping Ipecac, which is a medication that is frequently given to parents to induce vomiting, such that if there is a substance that is ingested, that it comes right back up.
Right.
That's always been the philosophy. It is a good idea to keep Ipecac. However, before giving it to a child, you really ought to talk with your primary care physician, your pediatrician, or at least poison control or a hospital emergency department triage nurse to find out, okay, here's what we think the child ingested. Should I give Ipecac before you give it? Because there are situations where giving Ipecac can actually make the situation worse with caustic substances that are ingested. And then the one thing that does come to mind is the ingestion of batteries. We don't think about little batteries, particularly these little watch batteries, as poisonous substances, but in fact they are. Hmm. And they can cause significant erosions in the upper airway, upper GI tract, that if you give Ipecac can actually make the situation worse. And it's a difficult situation to deal with batteries in the first place. You don't want to make it worse by inducing vomiting.
Right.
But yes, call a primary care, you know, your primary care physician, pediatrician, poison control, hospital emergency department to find out before you act whether in fact you should.
Okay.
Yeah, we seem to find those batteries in just about every orifice. You know, they stick them in their noses, they stick them in their ears, and they're small enough and they're interesting enough to a child that they want to play with them. But even in the nose, as that battery degrades, it is caustic and it can actually degrade the bony structures and cartilaginous structures of the nose and is a significant potential threat. So button batteries, mm-hmm. which are often in toys, watch batteries.
Electronic cards that sing or that you can record.
Yep. So they're very prevalent. We don't really think about them much. Some of the better designed toys will have small screw-in mm-hmm. covers, which are much safer than the click cover. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that is regulated at this point, but I don't think they're required to have a screw-down cover. But if you're looking at a toy and it contains a battery, and especially if it contains button batteries, you want to make sure there's a screw-down cover for that.
And Safe Kids has been a leader in calling attention to the issue.
Right. And I want to add to that, when you talk about the degrading of the battery, it can happen very quickly. We actually do a demonstration where we'll put them in a hot dog, and in just about 30 minutes, it's completely eaten through the hot dog. So it's important to kind of know these things, that it happens very quickly. You know, a parent might be thinking, oh, if it gets stuck, I've got a little bit of time. But in certain areas, it can happen very fast that it'll eat through that area of the body.
So it's a great point. This is not a marble. I mean,
they don't stay there, right?
Yeah.
And I know we're throwing out a lot of information
providing
a lot of recommendations and saying do this, not do that, or whatever. But there are resources that parents can refer to after this show. I mean, Safe Kids is an outstanding resource. The website for the American Academy of Pediatrics does have an awful lot of information about ways of prevention and data and when to call your physician, when to go to the hospital emergency department. So I'd encourage parents. I mean, you're using the internet an awful lot. Go to these resources because there's an awful lot of valuable and good information.
Excellent.
And he makes a great point. Let me also add some CDC resources. Parents can go to www.cdc.gov/safechild as an entry point to many of the prevention tips that you've heard all of us talking about.
Great. Thank you. Let's see. Now we're going to talk about some outside and sports injuries. And we have an expert here with us. We're talking about, bicycle, head injuries, concussions, symptoms, where do you go? So I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Resnick. He's got a lot to share.
Well, I don't know if I'm an expert, but I certainly have an interest. And I think it's a hot topic on everybody's minds, and it's an evolving topic. And I think that's what's really important here. We used to, with regards to head injuries, we used to grade concussions as a grade 1, grade 2, grade 3 to signify the severity of the concussion. We've moved away from that and basically made a very strong statement that a concussion is a concussion. And the most important thing about defining a concussion, there are whole lots of rules and tools used to assess concussions. But what I think is most important for parents, coaches, and trainers on the field when there is a head injury is that any symptom, any concussion symptom that is present after a head injury is a concussion. And that requires that the teen be withheld from additional activity until they've had a full evaluation by a health professional. So, that means, anyone who's got headache and dizziness has a concussion and cannot return to play. Many of these kids playing football, for example, have a helmet on. They're not going to have head pain from the point of trauma. The helmet protects against that. If they have a headache, that means they've had jarring of the brain inside the skull, and that headache is the only symptom necessary to diagnose concussion. There are many tools available for more sophisticated assessment, which can even be done on the sideline. And with the benefit of technology and smartphones, this has gotten even easier and, quite frankly, fascinating and changes, how we define and follow concussions. One in particular I'd like to bring everybody's attention to is called the SCAT-2, SCAT-2. The SCAT-2 is a sports concussion assessment tool, is what it stands for, and is available now as an app on smartphones, Android, iPhone, et cetera. You can download this app for free, and this is of particular importance to coaches and trainers on the sidelines. They can do a full SCAT assessment, which is a complete concussion assessment right there on the sidelines, get a score for that concussion, which is extremely valuable information that can be used not only to assess the initial injury, but to do the follow-up appropriately. But I think the overriding message from me is that we want to make sure that those concussions are being properly identified at the time of injury, and that those children are being withheld from participation until further evaluation. The last point that I'll make on this is that that there needs to be, if a concussion has been diagnosed or is assumed or there is a concern for, a health professional who understands concussion management needs to do the follow-up. And this can be tricky because there is no specialty training in concussion management, but I think that just a simple question asking the pediatrician or the urgent care provider, if they have expertise in managing concussions before they seek care there for follow-up.
I think it's absolutely critical to sort of reinforce some of the points that Dr. Resnick was making, that until, you know, if the brain hasn't had a chance to heal and that child or adolescent is returned to play and they experience another concussive event, that's a real challenge. CDC has for many years trying to raise awareness to the issue of concussion. We have a prominent campaign called Heads Up that has tailored information for both parents, caregivers, coaches, and trainers to guide them through many of the issues that Dr. Resnick shared in terms of signs and symptoms to look for, when it's appropriate to return to play, what kinds of questions to ask your clinician. Those are all essential. Several years ago, traumatic brain injury was not in the sort of consciousness of the U.S. population. Recent events, in addition to in the sports field, but also and on fields of battle, have raised our sort of general awareness about traumatic brain injuries.
And we used to just think that concussions were something that boys suffered. But now that we have more girls participating in sports at all levels, grammar school, high school, and certainly in the collegiate level, we're now seeing increasing number of these kinds of concussion and other injuries in girls. And when you think about some of the sports, lacrosse comes to mind. For boys, helmets are required. For girls, they don't wear helmets.
Oh, wow. Didn't know
and
that.
So therefore, there's a higher risk in lacrosse for girls than there are of boys. We need to think that we need to be aware that our girls at all ages are at risk for concussions and other injuries. Just because they're not bigger doesn't mean that they don't suffer from these injuries.
Absolutely.
One of the other things I like to mention to parents is, you know, a lot of your community coaches or rec league coaches don't have any kind of training. So they actually aren't trained on how to look for signs and symptoms of concussions. And so, you know, as a parent, it's okay to ask your coach, hey, have you taken any of the Heads Up training? It's free. It's online. Or just having that conversation with the coach and knowing what kind of training they've had and what kind of training they haven't had, and know that you as the parent, you know, you get to look out for the safety of your child and make those decisions. If something's not right with your child and your coach hasn't pulled your child, go ahead and pull your child yourself and say, you know, I'm really not okay with them. They don't seem to be okay. I'm going to pull them out and we're going to take them to the doctor. And we've talked a little bit about helmets and concussions. And one of the things that I really like to talk about in addition to sports helmets is helmets for other activities. You know, you wouldn't send your child into a football game without a helmet. You wouldn't send them up to bat without a helmet, so you shouldn't send them out on their bike or an ATV without a helmet, scooters, skateboards. All of those activities are activities that need a helmet, and so it's good to really talk about helmets in that way, kind of make it a normal part of every activity, every sporting activity. It can truly be a life-saving measure in some of the accidents that we see around bicycles and ATVs and things like that.
Excellent point.
I think we need to get to the point as a society where we've moved on from the old school, oh, he just got his bell rung. And the brain is not a bell. And if it were, if it gets rung, that's not a good thing. So, you know, again, that's usually used to define a kid who's not acting right after a head injury.
True.
So that's just we got to move away from some of the old ways that we used to kind of write these things off as just little minor injuries. They're not. And as has already been mentioned, if a child returns with a concussion and sustains another concussion, the results can not only be devastating acutely, but can cause chronic injury that's manifested long term. So
yes.
I think we – and then in addition to that, we have to get away from the parent pressure – to have these kids return to play. They are almost using the child as some sort of, award or trophy in their own life. And so they feel this urgency to get them back so that they can celebrate their performance. And we really do need to get away from that, regardless of you know, how important that athlete is to whatever sport they're participating in. There's nothing more important than their brain health long term.
Absolutely. Some of the other outside activities that we're going to be looking at soon would be sunburn, dehydration. So those two things particularly come to mind when you're thinking of summer. And so any comments on either of those two items there from you guys?
I mean, I'll say a couple things. First of all, sunburn is a burn, so it's treated much like other burns are, and I think it's well known how you prevent sunburn. whether we actually follow through with that as parents or as teenagers is another story. I will add one other thing. You mentioned sunburn and dehydration. What you didn't mention was heat-related illness. And in the South, heat-related illness is a major problem, and it's under-recognized. So people talk about dehydration. Sometimes that is a problem, but I actually think more frequently in this climate, heat-related illness. And it doesn't – heat-related illness doesn't manifest itself clearly. Okay, it's not like when you have the flu, you spike a fever and you start to cough, and those are the signs and symptoms of the flu. Heat-related illness doesn't do that, and unfortunately, what you find with heat-related illness and the neurologic changes that occur from that is the first thing you'll see change is decision-making. So if you notice a change in behavior, more reckless, impulsive decision-making, or confusion, that might be a sign of heat-related illness, and that needs to be assessed immediately.
CDC have anything to weigh in on that as far as heat-related injuries?
No, I think he's Dr. Resnick has raised some great insights. You know, I think proper hydration is absolutely essential, and one of the unfortunate realities is that by the time you have you've become dehydrated and showing signs of symptoms, that's well past the time that you will have needed to have consumed fluids to sort of keep your body hydrated. So it's one of those sort of precautions you need to be mindful of as you're outdoors and sort of be sensitive to throughout your time outside.
True. And I'm a great advocate of water. I think water is your key there for being well hydrated, but I know that that's maybe something else that we might want to speak to on the drink side for what are you giving your children for proper hydration. Any comments on that one?
Well, water is a very, very good source for hydration. However, there's the potential for kind of giving too much water,
okay,
because then you can dilute out salt.
All right, good point.
And so, you know, so there some of the athletic drinks are certainly, you know, good sources for salt, minerals, and a little bit of sugar. However, there's also the balance. We have to be balanced here in that there are excess calories with these sports drinks, and so consuming those puts you at a little higher risk for overweight and obesity. But in terms of hydration, water is a great source. It's generally free, And so easily accessible and first line in terms of drinking an awful lot of water to make sure, particularly in hot weather, that you're not, you know, getting dehydrated.
Yeah, I'm a little bit wary of sports drinks only because they're perceived as healthy drinks, and they're certainly not. There's just as much sugar in a sports drink as there is in a soda. And so they're overconsumed, I think, is the problem. They're certainly useful for rehydration and perhaps prevention of dehydration, but I think it's important that we not just, because of that, assume that they're healthy drinks to be drinking on a regular basis. They're not.
I agree. Absolutely. So this has been a great discussion, and I just appreciate so much everything. Any parting tips from any of each of you, or something that we should cover that we haven't covered?
I think in closure, one of the most important messages to get across when it comes to assessing a child who's sustained an injury, we learn this in medical school and again in more advanced training. Children are not little adults, and so you can't assess a child's injury from your own perspective. So simple examples are a child who has back pain after an injury. Well, you know, adults always have back pain after an injury. So you can't use your own – well, of course you have back pain. That's okay. It's not okay. Children with back pain need to be assessed for a number of reasons. It's not typically as simple as it may be in adults. Same with musculoskeletal injuries like sprains. Children, for the most part, don't sprain ligaments very easily. Their ligaments are very lax. And so they, you know, if a child is having a difficulty after an injury, sustaining weight, bearing weight on something, or using an extremity, don't write it off to a sprain, because they usually aren't sprains. They're either small little bone fractures or growth plate fractures, which are even more concerning. So just overall, caution is probably the best advice here.
Good.
I think from my perspective, I sort of want to recall folks to some of the resources that we called out earlier. So besides AAP and Safe Kids websites, I mentioned the CDC website, www.cdc.gov/safechild. You know, I'm an optimist by nature, and I mentioned the wide geographic variation that exists. And it's striking to me that if the U.S. national rate was equivalent to some of our European colleagues, or even the lowest U.S. state rate, we would have saved almost 5,000 more children last year. So as an optimist, there's absolutely much more we can do to protect the ones that we love. And those are the things that you heard from all of us today, are that there are things that individuals, families, communities, and our government can do to keep us safe and our children safe.
Well spoken.
And a parting thing, one thing that we haven't talked about, which is a subject for an entire show, is injuries related to children having access to firearms and guns. So therefore, all of these things, if in fact you have it in the household, should be completely locked and not available for any child, child being defined all the way up to age 18.
Another well-said statement there, absolutely, and we did not get to that. So another show for, and we'll have Dr. Keith with us.
My parting comment would be, earlier I joked about kids don't come with instructions or an instruction manual, but as everybody has already mentioned, there are resources out there. So if you're looking for something specific, the internet is a great place to find stuff through Safe Kids website, the American Academy of Pediatrics, CDC, and to find Safe Kids, it's just www.safekids.org. And there are all kinds of tip sheets and resources. There are guides to help you figure out how you can make your home environment safer for your child.
Great. So we've gotten the contacts from Safe Kids and the CDC. I'll go to Dr. Keith and let him tell us how to reach him here in the Atlanta area with Well Street.
Well Street, here again, we have 8 sites around the Atlanta area. Best to go to our website, www.wellstreet.com, and you can find information about our locations, our times that we're available, which is 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. every day of the year. And other tips that we have available on the website. So,
great. Is that good with you?
That's good with me. That's where to go.
Terrific.
Can I mention one more thing?
Absolutely.
The other resource that I'd like to mention for folks is Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. They are the pediatric trauma center here in Atlanta. So if your child gets injured, severely injured, that may be a place that you might find yourself, unfortunately. So I hope nobody ends up there. But and they have lots of information on their website as well, and that is choa.org.
Thank you, Megan, for bringing that to our attention. Appreciate it greatly. So we want to thank our sponsor, HealthGate, and listeners can hear more about HealthGate and also this program with information at www.healthgate.com. And we thank you so much for being with us, and the information shared today has been wonderful. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
The Doctor's Roundtable has been a production brought to you by HealthGate and Business Radio X. HealthGate is a groundbreaking website where board-certified doctors and specialists offer savings on out-of-pocket healthcare costs. For more information about HealthGate, please visit www.healthgate.com or call 404-692-5377. We hope you tune in next week, and thank you for listening.